Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And today's episode is another one in sort of our occasional series where we highlight different types of appellate practice in Texas and beyond. Our guest today is John Messinger, and he's going to tell us about working in the state prosecuting attorney's office. So, John, thanks for joining us. Can you kind of tell our guests a little bit about who you are, kind of where you came from and how you got where you are?
Sure. I'm originally from New Jersey, moved down here to go to law school at Baylor in 2003. I graduated pretty shortly thereafter. I started as a part-time employee under I think it was a federal grant doing protective orders at the office. Took me about 6 or 8 months to get on full-time as an assistant district attorney. 2 months later, the appellate chief, who really was the person in charge of appeals, all of them in our office, she announced she'd be leaving. And a couple months later, I was the appellate guy in Waco. McLennan County office at the time had 21 or 22 attorneys. And I was doing about 30 to 35 appeals a year, plus the oddball stuff that, you know, everybody else at the quote unquote firm dumps on you. I'm sure you understand what that's like. And after about 3 or 3.5 years, Lisa McMinn, who was the state prosecuting attorney at the time, asked me to apply. That was coming up in 2010 when she was going to be appointed. And almost didn't take the job because it was an election year. But unfortunately, my boss lost in 2010, lifelong Democrat. So he took the same bath everybody did up and down the ticket. And so I decided to take a chance and come down here. And I've been here for a little over 10 years at the state prosecuting attorney's office.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned when we were scheduling this episode is kind of the idea of unexpected opportunities and not closing the door. You want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I haven't done a podcast. And so I was listening to the interview you did with Justice Busby just to get a feel for it. And immediately says, well, my mom was a lawyer. So here I am at the breakfast table reviewing briefs and doing these other things. And so just the idea that he always knew he was going to be a lawyer and his career trajectory certainly matched that. He knew he wanted to go to this firm, to then go to the AG's office, to get this experience, to be an appellate judge, to one day be on the Supreme Court. And if you have that idea of what you want to do, that's great. I went to college wanting to be a mechanical engineer. I very quickly decided I'd much rather work with people than numbers. So I went into business. I finished with a degree in marketing, and then they had a 5-year master's program. So I did that. I worked in marketing for a meat company, a retail and food service. And then after that, quit, moved because I was young and stupid and thought, hey, I can live for a while without having a job. Came back when my dad got sick, when he was well enough for me to leave the house. I did what everyone did when you don't have a job. And especially this is right after 9/11. So the business job market up in the Northeast was pretty bad. So you go to grad school. And I actually went to law school planning to do family law. And then a little bit into it, Professor Sayre was teaching criminal procedure and criminal law. And I really loved that. I started, they had an internship program in the DA's office. So I said, I like this and I want to do appeals. But they had an appellate person, so I started on doing misdemeanors. And then unexpected, the appellate chief leaves. And then I'm at Waco, bought a house, loving my job there. And then I wasn't looking to come down here and work at the state prosecuting attorney's office. Like I said, I almost didn't take the job. So, you know, just at every step, and anytime I've talked to a civic group or high school kids or something, it's back. Maybe you shouldn't tell them. I just say, you know what? Don't have a plan. You know, everything, you just do the best you can wherever you're at and certainly look for opportunities if you know what you want to do. But if you don't, just keep your eyes open. And that's what's got me here. Also, ignorance and unjustified self-confidence. Those are the other two aspects.
Which is, it's an important part of any lawyer's toolkit, though, really.
Yeah.
It's a blessing to know what you don't or not know what you don't know sometimes. Might change the course of things.
And also just to have the you know, I say it's the mentality of almost a four-year-old. Like, why? Why do we do it that way? It's like, well, because we always have. What? Well, why? And I mean, at some point you have to grow up and provide the answer, but just the idea that you're just, this doesn't make sense and someone's going to have to explain it to me before I go along with it. And thankfully, I've had opportunities to ask the people who make those decisions to change, and it works sometimes.
Tell us a little bit about what the state prosecuting attorney's office is and kind of what they do, because I think a lot of our listeners probably aren't familiar with it.
Right. And I think I was telling you pre-show, there are some prosecutors who just never hear from us and never seek us out. And so discover us. People have been prosecutors 5-10 years. As near as I can tell, we're the smallest agency in Texas. Agency 213. We should sell merchandise. It's Stacy Soule, who's our state prosecuting attorney, me and Emily Johnson Liu, plus a secretary. So we're a four-person agency. The state prosecuting attorney is an appointed position. The Court of Criminal Appeals will appoint the SPA, and he or she serves in terms of 2 years at a time. No term limits. Usually, if you join this office, you either die or retire. Those are the only ways people leave this office. The position itself was created by statute in 1923. And in theory, we could represent the state in every matter before the Court of Criminal Appeals. But that would be dozens of cases on discretionary review every year, however many death penalty cases are still coming up, miscellaneous things like writs of mandamus and prohibition. And in any given year, somewhere between 3,500 and maybe 5,500 writs of habeas corpus that come out of prisons. So there's no way a three-lawyer office is going to be doing any, even a tiny fraction of that. So the majority of what we do is keep an eye on the courts of appeals, and we read every case that comes out adverse to the state. We figure out as best as we can on the limited information there. Thankfully, most of the briefings available online from the 14 courts of appeals. We figure out if it looks like something bad happened. And if we think so, we'll call out to the local office, ask if there's something we're missing, if there's any information that they can give us otherwise. And then also in terms of not keeping the peace, but figuring out exactly what's going on in a given case. Sometimes they've worked out an agreement. Sometimes that case is just going to go away on a factual basis. But if they'd like something to be done about it, and depending on the size of the office, they may ask us to do it or need us to do it. Because as you might be aware, there's some district attorneys who are the person in their office. Maybe they have an assistant for 3 or 4 counties in some of the more rural districts. So us calling out is sometimes a godsend, and we will figure out if it needs to be done. And if so, we'll file the petition for discretionary review. Sometimes we do a motion for rehearing first and then follow up the process. Sometimes we will get involved in the Court of Appeals if there's a really interesting issue that they contact us first. But you know how it is when you work at a firm and where you have people doing trials. It would be really fantastic if they asked you about the issue before they walked into the courtroom. Right.
Sounds familiar.
Right. And sometimes that doesn't happen. I mean, I was blessed in Waco that everyone would come to me first before there was something weird to happen, or they would call me down to the courthouse, and that was very easy to do. So I would just appear on, you know, in 3 pages of a record here or there out of the presence of the jury. But yeah, sometimes it's done by the time it becomes a defense PDR, and then it's granted. So occasionally we'll represent the state in the response brief in the CCA. And I looked at our numbers just to kind of give you a sense of this, because I don't know what's going on across the hall at the Supreme Court. But last year, in 2020, we filed 40 petitions for discretionary review. That's the real number. Technically, we filed 84, but an additional 44 happened to do with this kind of court cost issue that's on the side. It's literally a cut and paste each time. The CCA is just going to have to make a decision. But in terms of real different substantive PDRs, we filed 40 in calendar year 2020. And based on what the CCA granted yesterday, they granted another 5 cases for review. They're sitting on 100. Some of them go back to 2018, but they've got 100 cases they promised an opinion on. 20 of those are on our PDR, and we represent the state in another 6. So about a quarter of what's in front of that, the Court of Criminal Appeals, our office is representing the state. And I don't know, because civil practice is decentralized, except for whatever's going on at the AG's office, I don't know if their numbers are comparable. I don't know if you have the same relationship, because I can't imagine anything that happens civil that's them not representing the state would give them any power to step in for a private party. But that's kind of our gig.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
You know, the overview sort of suggests to me some similarities between your office and the Solicitor General's office. And I want to explore that. But before I jump into that, you mentioned those six cases pending at the CCA that were not petitions, you know, PFRs filed by the state prosecuting attorney's office. My question was, you guys get involved when the state is the respondent in a proceeding, or do you?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last four. Sometimes when it's a defense PDR that's granted, we'll immediately call out. And, you know, in fact, there have been times I've looked at the PDRs as they come in and I say, this one is probably a grant. This one looks a little sticky, and talk to the DA or the appellate attorney in the office who handled it and kind of make a soft commitment, seeing how things go, that we might be able to take it up for them. Sometimes they call us when it gets granted. It's like, well, what do we do? I don't know how to do this. This, you know, I'm a great trial attorney. I'm not an appellate guy. And a couple of them are on issues, things that I, for example, the ones that I'm doing, I'm representing the state in something related already. So I am neck deep in self-defense cases. It's been a thing for the last couple of years, First Amendment cases also. So if it's something like that, I will reach out, and I've been on their end, so I don't like taking projects. You know, it's kind of like those movies where the police are there and then the FBI comes and it's like, well, this is actually a federal office building, so we're taking a, we can do that. The statute says we can. I don't remember the last time we did, and that's under Stacey or Lisa McMinn. It's just, we want to get along. We want to be helpful. And as long as who we're talking to, it sounds like they've got a good handle on things, we're happy to read things over. We're happy to spend as much time on the phone as possible. We're not trying to steal anybody else's work, because I've been there, and they let me, Lisa let me do things when I was in Waco that gave me the experience to give her the confidence to hire me here. So that's just, you have to let people do that. But yeah, most of the time it's, hey, I've already pretty much briefed this. Would you mind if I did it for you? And most of the time they said, sure, I have many other things to do. So it works out well that way. I should also say we do a couple amicus briefs here and there. I think we did. I'll file one next week. So that'll be 4 out of 100. You know, we've also chimed in.
I know that in the last couple of years, there've been a couple of times when on a particular issue, the Texas Supreme Court will ask the Solicitor General's office to weigh in. And I know at the U.S. Supreme Court, they do that frequently. Does the CCA ever kind of call out to the state prosecuting attorney's office for views on anything? Or is that kind of not done?
No, partially because we're so ready to file an amicus brief if we want to be involved. I don't think they've ever asked us to. The 10th Court did one time when the Michael Morton Act passed and they first started seeing a bunch of cases coming up. They asked for the attorney general to chime in. They asked for us. They cast a wide net and they set an argument day. I think they had 4 or 5 cases pending. So they did, but no, I don't think the CCA, not in the 10 years I've been here, have they said, hey, we would love to hear from your office.
I know you mentioned y'all are an agency, so you're a separate silo from like the AG's office that has the SG under it. You're kind of your own independent group.
As near as I can tell, yes, short answer. And as near as I can tell, we're the only entity that does statewide prosecution that isn't part of the Attorney General's office. And every 2 years, there's always talk about, well, we can save $5,000 a year if we don't have a separate agency and the AG just takes them over. And every year, it doesn't happen. And I mean, I don't remember the last time there was a big fight. Normally when there's a big budget crunch, but I mean, I don't know how they would break that up, because you would have to sever the tie between our office and the Court of Criminal Appeals. And I imagine they like at least choosing the person who represents them. It's weird. I admit that it's weird. I didn't expect that to be the case when I first found out about the office. I wouldn't mind seeing a defense analog on the other side, but the problem is we can attempt to speak for the entire state, even though maybe a local officer or prosecutors can differ on what a law should be. But a defense attorney's entire obligation is to their current client. So it would almost be self-defeating to try to keep one eye on the general state of the law. At some point, you would not be serving that client effectively. So the fact that there can't be a balance on the other side doesn't mean that the appointment is less good, but we are apolitical. I mean, you wouldn't have the state prosecuting attorney, you wouldn't put her on a ticket every 4 years, but ostensibly everybody could be on the block depending what happens. And I think it just works out this way. I mean, I say that because this is what pays my mortgage and I don't want things to change, but it just, we're here. I don't know that anybody particularly has a problem with our office on the defense side. And I don't think their complaints about us being aligned with the court would go away if we were part of the attorney general's office. So we're kind of here quietly doing our thing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's quite a contrast with the Solicitor General's office being a part of the Attorney General's office, which of course the AG is an elected, publicly elected position. And from what you said, the CCA appoints the state prosecuting attorney. And gosh, those 2-year terms are pretty short, but it's interesting to hear that basically it's a practically lifetime tenure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going back. Lisa retired at 53. She had a lot of service in Fort Worth before she came on to work here. And before that, it was, Jeff retired. And before that, Matthew Paul died unexpectedly. So that really is the case. I mean, we're just a tiny little office that nerds that like doing prosecution, and it's a really great gig. I don't know that there's a better job for appellate prosecutors. I mean, maybe being in charge of appellate section of a larger office, so you have more of an opportunity to teach and coach up people. But, you know, I happen to know Judge Newell, and I joke with him a lot that he's extremely well-read. And whereas he's likely to give you a quote from Shakespeare, I'll give you a quote from a Star Trek episode I didn't realize was based on Shakespeare. I just think of whichever movie it was, I think Generations, where Kirk meets Picard. And Kirk just says, look, like, when you're in the chair, you can make a difference. You know, don't let them promote you. Don't let them retire you. You know, don't let them do anything that takes you off the bridge of that ship. And I kind of feel the same way here. Like, I get to talk to people I call, and thankfully people call us from around the state wanting help, and I get to work with them. And it's one of the things I missed being in Waco, because, you know, the trial attorneys, like, you know how it is with appellate attorneys. It's, you never have to deal with witnesses. If you're just doing the appeals, yes, you literally have to deal with clients, less so on the appellate, on the criminal side, but you also don't get to, at least in a criminal setting, I don't get to talk to the victim's family. You know, I don't get to have that direct contact where, you know, you're helping somebody to make a difference. And so working with the people who did and being their support was something I missed. So I'm glad I get a chance to do that here. And, you know, through speaking at CLEs and things like that, you know, putting out papers, we try to keep teaching people to do that. But I'm young. It's been a long time before I'd have to think about retiring. But it is hard to believe there'd be a time when I wouldn't want to be doing what I'm doing.
That's really cool. And you know, you are in kind of a unique position, because potentially you can work with lawyers from any of the 254 different counties across Texas, because, you know, in the civil side of things, we may or may not know lawyers in a particular jurisdiction, you know, or that court of appeals, or there just may not be a lot of civil cases out there, but pretty much every county has some sort of criminal issue come up at one time or another that is going to have to be addressed on appeal, I would imagine.
Yeah. And some of the most interesting issues have come from the smallest counties. I mean, you would think, well, if you're in Harris or you're in Dallas County, like, just by sheer volume, everything's going to come up here, but odd issues from around the state. And just, if you're here long enough, so I'm trying to think, I've represented the state in 70 some odd cases in front of the Court of Criminal Appeals. You know, if you flip through an annotated penal code, you're going to see tons of cases that were represented by our office. I mean, we make a real difference in the way prosecution works. And, you know, sometimes you think it's a giant deal because it's a high profile statute and the legislative process was messy and everyone's looking at this. But then you do something on the unit of prosecution for the failure to appear in court. And, you know, it's a short PDR. The issue is what it is. The opinion comes out quickly and you're like, OK, good. This guy gets 2 convictions. And then you get random emails from people across the state saying, this is a giant help to us. You have no idea. And it's just being able to get that feedback and realizing that sometimes the things you think are extremely important maybe are interesting for the appellate crowd that don't make a giant difference in everyday prosecution, but some of the other stuff does. So again, it's a blessing to be here. You just hope you're doing something that's helpful to, I keep calling them real prosecutors. Yeah, you know, every time they call. The view from the ivory tower is nice, but you know, it helps to stay grounded and talk to people who are having to make split-second decisions in court, having to sit down with the victim's family, having to look the defendant in the eye, you know, things that I don't get to and don't have to do.
That's an amazing record that you've got, you know, in over this 10-year or so period with 70 appearances before the CCA. What a great opportunity for you as an advocate. And of course, you know, the state being a great client, but you get all this variation in the folks that you get to work with, you know, 254 counties in Texas with all the different DA's offices around who want, I'm sure, varying degrees of assistance, as you've pointed out. Do you co-counsel with some of these DAs sometimes, or is your tendency to take the file over?
I can't remember. I think Stacy did one where they split the argument and they were both listed as co-counsel. But otherwise, if you want us to do it, great. If you want to do it, I have ghostwritten things, and just because for whatever reason, our office didn't want to, but it's like, here it is, put your name on it. That's fine. So everything from we'll give it a quick read or a phone call with you if you want to bounce some stuff to I'll half draft it for you, which doesn't happen often, maybe a couple of times in the last 10 years. But no, if we're not going to take it over, it's yours and we'll help as much as you want to get it across the line. Because again, I've been on the other side. And some people are, I mean, like I was saying, so there are some elected district attorneys who literally do everything. Like we'll go out to JB court and make deals on speeding tickets and have to do the grand jury and everything. They are more than smart enough to do the appeal, but it's a different skill set. And the amount of time it would take for them to do a PDR, it is just not worth it. Just when we're happy to do it, just let us do it. And I make sure I don't always make sure. I try very hard to make sure it is done and a draft is sent to them with enough time for them to give me ideas and feedback because they lived it. And there's some things that I may just miss because I was not in the courtroom at the time. And I always try to be mindful of that.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. And very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
We have the same conversations about civil trial lawyers, and there's all kinds of arrangements that can be made in working with civil appellate lawyers. And so I think for a lot of us, there's that preference of then take it over rather than, I mean, co-counseling is fine, but when you start talking about trying to merge work product, starts to get into the territory of what Jody describes as a Frankenbrief, which is, you know, kind of funny, but you get the concept. So I think that's just very impressive. And one of the things I don't have a good feel about on the criminal side is how developed the criminal appellate bar is. You're one of our first guests, John, who really has a criminal practice, certainly representing the state, but that's your area of practice. Do you see the same lawyers over and over again on the other side of cases that you're arguing? Is there a very well-developed criminal appellate bar?
There is, and every city seems to have their made guys, so to speak. But yeah, short answer is yes. I have eyes on every PDR that comes in. That's largely a waste of time. The grant rate hovers between 6 and 9%. And so I'm not going to say I read every PDR that comes in, but I glance at it. I look at the issues really quickly, and I look to see who it's from. And there are certainly a lot of names that come up regularly. So, yeah, I think in the appellate world, I know Houston's got a pretty developed defense bar, and I'm more familiar with them, but I'm sure Dallas and Fort Worth, if I sat down to look at it. And frankly, a lot of them, you have people who are at the DA's offices in those counties long enough to where they eventually go into private practice. But for both of them, like Fort Worth had people who had been there for 20 and 25 years. And then I do not know if it results of regime change or just it was that time, but there were a lot of people who all of a sudden from both Dallas and Tarrant County went to the other side, which is good. I mean, you've been there. There's nothing worse than trying to answer a brief that you can't understand. Like I'd much rather face a well-written, devastating brief and deal with it than have to say, especially on the criminal side, when they are going to rightfully construe things liberally to make sure somebody's right to an appeal is honored. So this should never be the case, but especially when I was in Waco and just doing run-of-the-mill appeals, I can't tell you how many times my response was longer than their brief, which, I mean, you wouldn't think that would happen. You'd think they would have crystallized the issues and you can get down to it because hopefully haven't misrepresented the facts. Hopefully they've identified the proper law. So you can cut and paste that stuff, but I try to make things as short as possible. It's almost a game now.
It's a real skill, but as you say, it's super challenging to do that when the other side hasn't really drilled down on the issues, and you have to sort of anticipate how the court's going to respond to whatever it is they did file and maybe take some, what, a little thread of an argument and run with it in a way that you wouldn't think would happen. It really is a difficult part of it from the civil side. It's interesting to hear, and I'm not surprised that you see it on the criminal side as well.
And it goes back to something you said earlier about just the amount of time I've been practicing almost exclusively in front of the CCA. It's the familiarity with the court. You know, I can guess which judge would be likely to grab onto something that is underdeveloped, but something in their wheelhouse. Now, that's gotten harder. I have now been at this office longer than 7 judges have been on the court. So we've had a lot of turnover in the time that I've been here. Now, again, thankfully, I knew Judge Urey before he was Judge Urey, and I knew Judge Newell before he was Judge Newell. And just because of our proximity to the court, I'm able to interact with them pre-COVID anyway. At functions, we go to every argument. We're always there in person when they're held. So, and I think that gives me a little bit more leeway, you know. And then I honestly don't know if this is the way it happens on the civil side of things, but I've always been teaching oral argument or brief writing, just try to help them solve a problem. You know, we have more of an obligation to justice. You have obligations to your client. So there's only so much you can do. But, you know, I worry sometimes that I become over familiar, but I really try to have the attitude of, hey, the 10 of us need to work this out. I understand what the weakness in my argument, like, you don't even need the other guy or girl. Like, I'm telling you, like, I understand my argument has flaws, but here's how we get around them, or here's why this is the better outcome. Because there's a lot of these, I mean, some stuff is cut and dry. And frankly, I've probably lost more unanimous decisions than I've won. But most of the time, there are equities on both sides. And, you know, you're dealing with issues of fundamental fairness, which I understand on the civil side, you have that too. But sometimes it's very, I'm not sure that I could do half the job I'm doing on civil appeals. Because I glance at them occasionally to figure out what the issues are and what's going on. And it's just impressive. It's just such a broader array of things. And that's why it's always confusing to me, because I think criminal law is easy. So when we have these courts of appeals that have to go both sides, like, well, if you've had to master regulatory law and governance law and everything else, like, you can pick up some search and seizure stuff. Like, I like to think it's not that difficult. It is. And every time I think we've tackled a big issue, the CCA, you know, there's a new big issue to be addressed. But it's an interesting job. I can't imagine having a single Supreme Court the way SCOTUS does it. I mean, they have an army of people helping them out. But to have somebody comfortably say, I'm a master of both criminal and civil law, God bless them. I don't know.
Well, and you talked a little bit about kind of the outsized influence that your office has. But as you were talking, it really did sort of click for me. You know, the Supreme Court standard to take a case in Texas is important to the jurisprudence of the state, and that can vary wildly in case to case. But it really, in your cases, every time the state comes in, whichever way the decision goes, it really does have a huge impact on all potential criminal prosecutions in Texas, depending on the issue. I mean, it's something every county is going to have to look at and think about and study and make sure it doesn't impact the way that they do their jobs in a way that I don't think is necessarily true on the civil side. I think there are certainly cases where it does, especially when you talk about rules and you know, jury charge practice and that kind of stuff. But just the nuts and bolts impact on everybody's daily practice across the state is not necessarily the same in the Supreme Court as it is in the CCA.
Yeah. And some of the bread and butter issues like traffic stops, you know, there aren't new laws on traffic stops. There are occasionally new Supreme Court cases, and you sometimes hit an interesting issue or just a factual scenario that makes you have to rethink things. But the rules for granting review on paper look about the same as the Supreme Court's. I was interested to find out, I think it was a couple of years ago, I found out that you do pre-grant briefing on a petition. I guess that helps you make sure it's really worth taking, but it seems like it's semi-granted at that point. So
yeah, everything is briefed before the court grants it. You know, when they grant it, it is generally you're now set for oral argument, come show up, or you'll get a per curiam opinion a few months later that, you know, you didn't know it got granted, but hey, by the way, it's granted and here's our opinion. But we don't have the practice that, you know, like at the Supreme Court, the US Supreme Court, where you have a petition and then they'll grant it and ask for a merits briefing. It all happens here kind of before. And I guess that was one of the things I kind of wanted to talk about was maybe differences in criminal and CCA practice. So at the CCA, you start with a petition and then it gets granted and then you move to merits briefs.
Right. Interestingly, as near as I can tell, all the other courts of appeals around the state will, since they have to take it without granting review, they won't decide whether or not to have argument until somebody's drafted an opinion and they've hit a roadblock. It's like, hey, okay, your briefing didn't address this, or we've come up with something new, we'd like to talk to you about it. The CCA will grant oral argument when it grants your petition. And the petition's limited to 4,500 words, which isn't awful. I don't think you need anything close to that if you have a truly reviewable issue. My average is about 1,300 and change. So, I mean, 4,500 words using what rule, was it 9.5, requires you to count. That can be 27 pages, 14 point double spaced, if you don't abuse footnotes like I do. So yeah, it's awful, but I just refuse to skim 7 lines of string cite. I'm just in the body of a brief. I just can't do it. Do what Brian Garner tells you to do, kids. Don't listen to Mr. Messenger, but yeah, like if the case needs to be discussed, it's in the body. If it's uncontroversial, I bury it. That way you can come back and read it clean without having citations breaking it up, but that's not why you asked me here. Yeah, so you do what is usually a pretty short PDR, and they decide, yeah, this is worth talking about, which I've always thought is odd, because sometimes argument is not helpful. Maybe it's not necessary, but sometimes it kind of is what it is, and they did good briefing. So committing to doing oral argument before you have the briefing that may make it unnecessary, I don't get it, but that's the way it's been done, and nobody's made me judge yet. So that's the way it'll keep going. And then my understanding of things is after the briefing's done, unless they spot something else, it gets set for submission pretty quickly. And then after that, they have guidelines, internal non-binding guidelines. And I know they're non-binding because there's no indication they're followed, but they're arbitrary. Any guideline would be arbitrary, right? So you say, okay, it's been assigned to you. You voted for what's now the majority opinion. It's been assigned to you 6 months to get it out. Well, maybe it's more complicated than 6 months. Maybe you were working on 3 other things that were all 2-week opinions, and everybody needs time. So you set out having guidelines. Then there's pickup guidelines for the side opinions and things like that. And then sometimes the majority shifts, but they sometimes get things out quicker than other times, I guess and that's just demonstrably true. I mean, right now, like I told you, they've got 100 cases, including about 8 they've granted in the last 2 weeks. So I figure 90 cases before that. Some of them were submitted in early 2019. And I guess this might be more helpful. 8 of them have got a 2018 petition number. That doesn't mean they were submitted. That's just when the PDR was filed. And it could have been as late as December 31st. So just to give you an idea, the revenge porn case I'm representing the state in, we're in year 3 of that. Like we're just barely getting into year 3 of when it was submitted. Complicated case. Nobody has made the First Amendment easy to do. I'm not necessarily knocking the court, but I think it's the oldest one they have pending. And then after that, I've had opinions come out in 3 months after submission, you know, so it just depends on what it is. And that's not even helpful. That gives you no insight. Sometimes things take longer than others, says Mr. Messenger, like worthless.
Pearl of wisdom right there.
Right.
Oh, I want to ask you, John, you mentioned that your optimum length of a PDR is, you said somewhere around 1,500 words, something like that.
A little under, yeah.
So you're, as on behalf of the state, you're really zeroing in on probably one issue, it would seem, at that sort of brevity. Because, I mean, we've talked here a lot about issue selection and, you know, how to go about, how many are sort of the optimum number of issues to take up on the civil side. But I would suspect that on the defense side of things, you probably see the same thing that we see sometimes in civil practice, which is folks who aren't super experienced in handling appeals tend to present more issues and not necessarily present them as well as someone who was more experienced would do. So What would you say about the general number of issues that you see, not only in your own petitions, but also on the defense side?
I do a PDR presentation at the advanced criminal law course. Usually they make me do it every, they make me do it each time they hold it. What I've seen is not only are people not reconsidering what the purpose of a PDR is, as opposed to their brief to the lower court. I mean, you're speaking to a different court. You're trying to convince them to take an issue, not convince somebody else you're right. I mean, it helps. But so not only do they not get the point and write it differently than they should, I've seen lots of people straight up cut and paste. And I know this because one, you can go back and look at their briefing, but two, they didn't even change the references to this court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. Like you can, and so I like, first off, like don't cheat. Like that is cheating. But two, your brief to the Court of Appeals is not going to serve the same purpose. It's not going to be as good. Not even your motion for rehearing in the Court of Appeals is going to do what a PDR does. Now, in terms of issue, and that's why you get these PDRs that just literally raise all 7 points of error that were raised in the Court of Appeals. Well, that's garbage. And immediately someone's going to take this less seriously. I will say that when you're the state, you artificially have fewer issues to pick from because they don't have to address all the issues when the state loses. Like if they're not going to reverse on sufficiency, which would grant the greatest review, relief rather, for acquittal, then they would just go to the first one that would grant a new trial. And maybe they'll look at another issue that is likely to be an issue in a new trial. And that's it. So you've artificially cut down on what I could be doing. So I would like to say that I'm just really good at picking the best issue and I never leave anything on the table. But a lot of it is like, no, you screwed us on the length of the stop. So my PDR is now about the length of the stop. That's it. Now, everything can be subdivided. And I have, on at least one occasion, have written what I thought was a laser-focused question for review. And the Court of Criminal Appeals was like, yeah, so we're going to refuse yours, but we're going to grant our own motion on something that looks just like it, but slightly vaguer. And now they ended up deciding it exactly how I asked them to and on the same grounds. But I can see that they wanted to give themselves more wiggle room. So while, in my paper, I'll walk through a progression, just like the worst thing you can do is say the Court of Appeals erred when it held, the trial court didn't err when it did X. Like, it's just don't do that. And in all caps.
Yes, all caps.
And it's just like, well, now I have no idea what this is about. It'll say like the admission of evidence. I'm like, oh, well, there are only 2 grounds to admit evidence. So this is easy. So yeah, even when you get away from that, it's like you can still expand something. And sometimes if you want to break it down into a separate question about the error and you think they did the harm analysis wrong alternatively. But I do keep track of all this because I do the paper and I try to, with the qualification that it's easier to be brief when you're the state, say like, these are how many had, I call them like a case event, and then the number of questions that spun out of it. So like the case event was the motion to suppress or the ruling on this piece of evidence or this jury charge question. So I'm really complaining about one thing. If it has 3 sub questions, then it has 3, but it's, the court will be pretty liberal about embracing, addressing what's embraced in the argument section of your petition.
Are you saying that the court will grant review on only some issues, less than all issues that are raised in the petition?
I think I've seen some where they want to grant the error, but not the harm issue because they've done it a lot. Usually they'll just grant it and then not reach it. But there are definitely times when you've asked them to review 3, what I call case events, and they're just like, nope, we're just taking the second one.
And so you know that before you even get to your merits briefing stage and the oral argument, usually, right?
Oh, that'll be on the white card. It'll say granted as to issue 4.
That sounds really nice from the civil perspective where you have the total opposite. You've put everything in the kitchen sink into your brief on the merits. It's all there. Supreme Court grants your petition. Typically, if they're going to grant one petition and there's another one, they'll grant them both and bring it up together. And then, you're getting ready for oral argument, being prepared to discuss everything in the case. It would be very nice if you had the opposite where you really don't even have to get into it in your merits brief until the court has told you what they want to talk about. And then you get to oral argument and you know the issue that they're interested in.
That's funny. I know that some courts of appeals will send out a letter designating an issue, a specific issue. And that's what we do in death penalty cases. And you can imagine how many points of error, because the death penalty cases are direct appeal to the CCA. There could be 57 or 78 issues. And a third of them are the same 8th Amendment stuff that come up in every case. But they're like, we've set it for argument. They don't give you a number, but you really can't possibly do more than two separate issues. You almost always argue one and a half just because of the way the conversation goes. So, but they ask you to, if you're the appellant, they ask you to pick a couple. And maybe once or twice I've seen the state designate something other than that. But other than that, no, I'm kind of surprised given how many issues you can have in a civil case that the Supreme Court doesn't give you a heads up as to what they're curious about.
Yeah. To your point, I've seen a couple of times the Court of Appeals will send a letter to the parties that says, hey, we want to talk about X. But even that is very rare on the civil side. I can maybe think of one or two times in the last 15 years that I've seen that.
Think about how much shorter merits briefs could be. If you know, party raises, say, five issues in their petition and the Supreme Court says, well, we only want to hear about one of those. Time that would be saved on the briefing side and the expense of it. I can see it both ways, I suppose, but change is hard. You know, trying to put a movement to do something like this in on the civil side, I think might be pretty difficult, but I like to look at things from an efficiency standpoint. And gosh, if the court knows it's really only interested in that one issue, wow, what a neat little trick to be able to say, yeah, focus on issue three and, you know, we don't need to hear any more about the other two or three issues.
Yeah, especially when combined with the pre-grant brief, you think that would help them say, these issues are garbage. So double up your effort, because it's not like they give you more words to work with if there are more issues, right? And I'm the last person to say, because this is what I learned from one of my professors, they said, look, if they give you 50 pages, use 50 pages to advocate for your client. And if they give you an hour to talk, talk for an hour. And even as a know-nothing law student, I said, that sounds like awful advice. Can I talk for an hour? Yes, sir. Do you want to hear me talk for an hour? And one of the lines I use in my PDR presentation is like, you all may be good legal writers. How many of you think a judge has ever gotten to the end of your brief and said, that's it? That's, we're done? I want another 20. It just doesn't happen. And I've really tried to focus on writing, not tersely, but as concisely as possible with getting the point across. It reads better. I don't know any professional who's telling people write more because judges don't have enough to read.
Well, and I imagine that's particularly true at the CCA, given all the different types of proceedings that they have headed their direction at any given time.
Oh, and how many thousands of them are handwritten from inmates, many of whom seem to have a pretty good handle on the law, but it's a lot to slog through, and they've got a giant staff helping them do it. But yeah, you're all over the place. And if every brief was 15,000 words, because it could be, well, I guess the opening brief is 15,000, but then the response brief was, 7,500, absent an extension on our side. So yeah, you have to read 22,500 words just because the rules say it's permissible. You wouldn't do that. And I have a hard time believing they actually get to the end of the briefs. Like once they understand what you're saying, I never understood this about US Supreme Court briefs too. I remember the first time I read one in law school, I thought I was reading the brief, but I was just reading the summary, which was about 8 pages. And I said, this is a pretty darn good brief. Why are you repeating all of it for an additional 40 or 60 pages? I understood what you were saying. I can click on all those cases, but what do I know? Nobody invites me to argue there either.
Well, that's an interesting question, is why not? I mean, the state surely is a party at the US Supreme Court from time to time. I mean, I know it's rare, but as y'all's office, I mean, if there is a criminal case up at the US Supreme Court, I would assume that y'all would have the opportunity to be involved.
No, we're not statutorily authorized to represent the state there. You would have to set up an arrangement where you were being borrowed by the local office to do it. And that's if the Solicitor General doesn't want to do it. That's their gig. So we don't try to encroach upon what they're doing, and we try to keep doing what we're doing. Yeah, it might be interesting one day.
I don't think of the SG's office touching anything on the criminal side. So that does happen?
Yeah. I'm trying to think the last time there was a petition for writ of cert on a Texas criminal law matter. I mean, the death penalty, outside death penalty stuff, Moore and all that.
Lawrence and Garner is the last big one and that's been a long time.
Post-Lawrence, Alan Curry, when he was with the Harris County office, I want to say it was Saldano. I may be confusing it though, but it was a Fifth Amendment issue. Guy was asked a question, I think, about a shotgun. It was the admissibility for impeachment purposes of a statement that was un-Mirandized. So otherwise inadmissible, but I think that was the gist of it. But he may have been the last person to argue a regular criminal case in the Supreme Court. I know him too through the Pattern Jury Charge Committee, so maybe I'll ask him. and get a recording.
Oh, that's fascinating, really. These are things that civil appellate lawyers just don't really think about. And you've pointed out some pretty significant differences, really, between your substantive practice area, the court you practice in a lot, what we do all the time. I think there are some things we can learn from a criminal lawyer.
I'm also salaried, so you may not want to copy everything.
One thread that I kind of hear through this conversation is that, you know, the advocacy skills are largely the same. If you had to bone up on a certain area of the law, you could do it. You've got the writing skills, analytical skills, and the verbal presentation skills to be an effective advocate. Some of it's probably just degree of comfort, because I can't imagine going into the CCA and, you know, arguing with someone's freedom on the line. I can argue all day long if it's just money. So,
right. Don't tell your clients it's just money, Todd.
It's definitely more than just money to them. I'll admit that. So I'm not going to edit that out, though, because it is my true view. And
I mean, obviously, when someone's life is on the line, but I mean, most people are not going to be criminals or the victims of crime, but lots of them are going to have a job or a car accident or a small business. So, I mean, it can be more dramatic, but like on an everyday basis, you know, what civil practitioners are doing for regular people is, you never want to say more important, but every bit as important as what we're doing. I mean, I want people to have a sense that should something truly awful happen to you, that there's a justice system that works reasonably well, but more people are going to have need of a civil attorney, thankfully. And I'm impressed. I'm not sure if I can move laterally to do it. It's even fair to call it a lateral move, but I might take a shot one day. I don't know. Dog bites and tree branches is what my Civ Pro professor said. Just hang out a shingle. You can always do those.
I know how the Supreme Court has handled COVID and kind of going virtual. Has the CCA gone virtual? Are y'all doing virtual oral arguments over there and that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. I've done two so far. I think they've had maybe 4 or 5 virtual argument days since it all went down. I think they're doing virtual on the, because I don't know when Chief Justice Hecht's order extends to. I think they kicked it back till maybe April or May. So they'll have another argument in a couple of weeks in the court, but I've enjoyed it. Thankfully hadn't had any technical difficulties, but you know, when you're standing there in real court, I like it. There's nothing like standing at the podium, but it's also like sitting at the front row of a movie theater. I mean, it's about 160 degrees to pan from left to right and watching the Brady Bunch formation where, you know, you can get everyone's reaction immediately. There may be a slight delay on something, but unless you're really speaking quickly, you can look at the smirks and the grimaces. And I think that's been helpful. I prefer being in person, but I've not had a big problem with it so far.
Great. Well, come to the end of the time that we have allocated to visit with you, John. You've been very gracious with your time. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, it's been great. I've really enjoyed the opportunity.
I've learned, as I thought I would, I've learned a few things today, and hopefully our civil appellate listeners will do the same. And then we really are wanting to have some more representation on the criminal bar. This may be it is the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, but we do have definitely a civil slant to us. And we're, you know, we would all benefit from hearing more about how it's done on the criminal side, not only from the prosecution side, but also from the defense side. So we're going to be on the lookout to putting together some shows on that subject soon. But one thing we like to do as we wrap up is we like to ask our guests if they have a tip or a war story to share with our listeners. Do you have anything?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. One of the stories I tell most often is from when I was back in Waco. Is a Darlene Gentry case. She shot her husband for no reason, just really no reason. We could not figure out a motive other than it seemed easier than divorce. And it really was awful. But the linchpin to the evidence was there's a videotape of her hunting around a stock tank. It was a hot summer and she had dumped the gun in a lake. And we had, I think the marshals were involved. I'm sorry, the Rangers. They had the owner of the tank because she had been very sketchy about wanting to buy it. For no reason. Like all of a sudden, she's like, hey, can I buy that property with the pond? So they told her, sure, but we're going to drain it. And so that caused her to go out and poke. And she's on video, blonde hair and everything, poking around with a stick in a foot of water to find the gun that we had already recovered. And so her argument on appeal was that, well, I had a lawyer and you didn't tell me when you had your agent, landowner, call and tell me that you were going to drain it. And so there's a whole oral argument about that. And that's interesting. You can read the opinion if you want to, but I tell the story because I think that's the only case I've argued. And I think I've argued 38 or 40 cases where, as far as I know, any victim's family members showed up. It's normally an empty courtroom up there in the temp court. And the victim's father came up to me afterwards, and we were the last argument of the day. And Chief Justice Gray said, well, okay, we're now going to adjourn for consideration of these cases. Just very pro forma announcement. And we walked out, and God bless him, the victim's father came up. He said, so you think like maybe an hour? And it just reminded me, and thankfully we had a visiting justice. And when that happens, things move pretty quickly. So I accurately, as it turns out, told him maybe 2.5 or 3 months. It's always served as a reminder of just, you know, you sit through you wait months to do the trial. And then the trial happens. And at least in Waco, you don't have to wait long for a verdict on murder one way or the other. And then you wait months for the appeal. And then you hope you're going to finally get that closure. But, you know, the appellate process is just so deliberate and so drawn out. It's a funny story for practitioners because whatever. And I'm pleased not at his expense, but just a reminder of just what the process is like. So I'll never forget that.
Oh, I can see why. That's very interesting to hear and a little sad. Well, before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please send an email at hosts@techsaplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.